Welcome to The Scrub Life, a podcast for and about the incredible profession of surgical technology. I'm Chris Blevins, and our mission at The Scrub Life is to educate the public about surgical technology. Each episode dives into the wonderful world of surgery, where we inform and hopefully entertain our listeners while interviewing amazing individuals within the field and presenting the hot topics everyone wants to know more about. Certified surgical technologists are an integral part of the sterile team that cares for patients in the operating room. Learn more about this exciting field, the immense effort that goes into educating future CSTs, and how you too can become a ninja of the OR. Now, without further ado, here's the latest episode of The Scrub Life. Hey everyone, Chris Blevins here. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Scrub Life podcast. Today, I am throwing it back. You all are going to have the opportunity to hear an episode that I did about a year ago with Chris Ahern. We spoke at length about his experiences in the initial accreditation process. Chris is an incredible advocate and cheerleader for our profession and has always been such a wealth of knowledge for those of us who are in education. So I can't wait for you to hear it. The reason why I wanted to republish this is because Chris wrote an article for the ARC-STSA newsletter. That's our accrediting body for those of us who are in the field of surgical technology education. That article can be found both at the ARC website, arcstsa.org, and can also be found through the link in our own website at thescrublifepodcast.com. It's an awesome look at surgery in space and how that is soon going to be something we're all going to have to tackle as the challenges for space exploration continue. So please read the article, support Chris, and also enjoy this episode. He's vastly become a wonderful friend, and I cannot wait for you to hear it. All right. Well, so first of all, I would just like to say thank you to Chris Ahern for letting me interview you and definitely pick your brain tonight. This is a really important, I think, process that a lot of people go through that can be super daunting. So thank you very much for taking time away from your golf game to spend a little time with me. I want to get to know you just a little better. Obviously you've got a really cool first name. So, I mean, we've got to go up from there, right?
Absolutely. We start from there.
Yeah. So tell me about your background just personally and, you know, how you became a CST. We'll talk about how you got into education, but first I just kind of want to get to know you as a person.
Sure, Chris. I just want to say thank you indeed for inviting me on your podcast. I'm happy to share my experiences with the listeners out there. Hopefully we'll have a lot of listeners, and hopefully this evening we'll be able to shed some light on this rather difficult process that our program just underwent.
Yeah.
And I'll try to shed some light on it from the perspective of someone who is not with any of the credentialing bodies. In other words, I don't want to give the impression that I'm going to put out information that comes from the ARC or comes from KHEP. I want to give the listeners the perspective of someone who worked closely with those two organizations and what was required to get to the point where we are today, and
yeah.
that is as an nationally accredited program through the KHEP, which yes. we're very proud of.
And should be, yeah.
So, yes,
so who is just, who's Mr. Chris Ahern?
So, my background it starts very young. I joined the Air Force in 1978, and right out of high school, 3 months out of high school, I was at basic training, and I had a choice. I could have been a plumber's assistant, or I could have been an operating room technician, because back in those days, that's what we were called, OR techs.
OR techs,
so,
yep.
I distinctly remember having to make that decision in the den of my parents' house and on the phone. And I said, all right, let me go work in the operating room. I mean, and that was literally what started me on this path that I find myself on still. And that was in 1978. So I joined the Air Force, basic training, went off to tech school and loved it. I think a lot of us out there, a lot of the listeners and you, I know, Chris, we just fall in love with this profession. And
yeah.
so, you know, the more you get into it, you can learn so much, or you can just scrape by. And I didn't want to just scrape by. So in the Air Force, they look for people that are kind of motivated in all military branches, for that matter. And at that age, I was motivated to learn as much as I could about the job. And I had some really good role models back in the day, and one of them was an OR tech named Max, who knew so much about his service, which was orthopedics, that I said to myself, I want to be like Max. And I think we've all probably had those people in our lives.
Oh my gosh. Many, right, at different stages,
yes,
for sure.
And so when I met Max, I was, I think, 18 or 19 years old. And I said, I want to strive to be kind of where he is. He was drawing pictures of radius and ulnar fractures with 6-hole plates and screws and 3-5 cortical and
wow.
cancellous screws. And, you know, just as a young person, you see that. And so he kind of, Max, if you're out there listening, which I doubt, but if you are, thank you. For setting me on this path, so I was discharged from the Air Force in 1982. Came home to Long Island, started work immediately at North Shore University Hospital, where I learned how to do cardiac surgery, vascular surgery, and major trauma surgery. It was a long process, but being someone who wanted to excel, you know, I went to work every day trying to learn something new.
Yeah.
That was 82 to 86. I was at North Shore. In 86, I decided to leave the operating room and become a salesman for Stryker Orthopedics.
I can see that.
Yeah, that, you know, I don't know anybody out there. I'm sure there are some out there who want to look into sales, and I would highly recommend it. However, the lifestyle just wasn't for me. It was, you know, a lot of driving, a lot of knocking on doors and that kind of thing. And I wanted to get back to the operating room. So in 1988, I started my career at Stony Brook University Hospital on Long Island, and I worked there until I just retired in 2021. So that was 33 years there.
Wow.
Yeah, in their operating room, and they're at Level 1 Trauma Center on Long Island in Suffolk County. So
yeah.
That's my background, you know, led me to this program director job that I have now after retirement.
So you just got out of the OR then. You've been behind the mail for a really long time, huh?
I have, yeah. It's been the source of my family, believe it or not. My wife is an OR nurse. I mean, so
awesome.
So if it wasn't for the operating room, you know, my two daughters would not be here. So,
well, speaking of your two daughters, did anyone else go into the medical field, or?
I think no, they did not. My
yeah.
two daughters are in their mid 20s now, and neither of them, one of them is in the medical field, but not in the slice and dice, quote
yeah.
unquote, medical field that we're in.
Oh, not the fun part. Yes.
Yeah, not the fun. That's what I say. But my wife and I think my wife and I had so many conversations at the dinner table about cases that we did that our kids just said no thank you. So
they
didn't, but it was nice. You know, my wife is still a huge help to me and a resource for me.
Sure.
You know, she's CNOR.
Awesome.
So that's cool. a bit about me.
Well, so I've yet to meet someone that is in our field that said, man, when I grow up, I want to go into education. You know, like when I'm a big kid, I want to become a director. I want to become a coordinator. I've heard lots of people that say, hey, I think I could adjunct because I like to precept. But I think changing your entire path and making education of others the focus, I think most of us come by it by happenstance. So how did that happen for you? How did you get into education?
So I'm a new program director. So, the last 2 years I've been program director. So I was program director while still working part-time at Stony Brook. So the clinical education in 2001, I was hired at Stony Brook to be their surgical tech educator. In other words, we ran a perioperative program where nurses from around our own hospital would come and be trained in the operating room. And then we also had a surgical tech program for a brief time.
Yeah.
So in 2001, I was hired as, or rather promoted, I guess you could say, as into a surgical tech educator in my operating room at Stony Brook. So that was kind of my entrance into the formal education. But, you know, I'm sure just like you, you've been teaching since you knew how to scrub a case, right? You're
right.
Always wanting someone to load the suture a different way or show them how to put a pledget on it on a SH needle quicker or something like that, right? So
yeah, we've been educating surgeons too. So, but that's another episode.
Well, yes. Well, that's the old give them what they need, not what they ask.
Exactly.
For, right?
Yeah. No. So you were in the education program, which I think is really commendable for that hospital. You know, there are always like OR educators, there are, nursing educators, there are all that. But to have a hospital that has education specifically for the surgical technologist, I think really it's few and far between. So, you know, congratulations and applause goes to them for doing that.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Thanks for recognizing that, because it was a new position, and it wasn't just me. There was another evening shift surgical tech who were hired, and I think what we did, and the workers that we trained also, they bought in 100%, and they became better surg techs and better scrub nurses not for what I specifically did, but just the fact that there was somebody that they could lean on or get a schedule from, or have somebody keep track of their cases. It's just that kind of stuff that matters.
Absolutely.
So then this 2019, I got hired as the program director at the college I'm at now. And, you know, that was a leap of faith. That was something that I wasn't, I'm sure you understand, and a lot of the listeners out there understand, that you go from the operating room where you're comfortable into the college setting where you're not comfortable.
Oh my gosh, yes. Yeah.
It was quite a culture shock. Any of the program directors out there listening, coming from the same path from the OR right to college, it's not unusual to feel what you're feeling.
You feel like a fish out of water. And then their acronyms, you know, the acronyms that are used in academia are totally different from the ones that we use in the medical field. And so, you know, you have to figure out what language it is that they are even speaking. And that sometimes, good God, that can be half the battle right there.
It can be. It can be half the battle. And I think that for the college to hire a surgical tech, a certified surgical tech, to be a program director, I think looking back, it's probably it's important for the program, the CST, to be aware of what they're getting into. But I think it's also important for the college to be aware of what they're getting. They're getting somebody from a clinical background, not necessarily an administrative background. Mm-hmm. And I think that sometimes needs to be you know, going forward, I guess.
Yeah.
We could spread the word.
Sure. Well, so why did this college feel the need to create a surgical technology program? What was kind of the basis behind that?
Well, the college is very active in the community. Workforce development is a big thing now. Obviously, it always has been, but I think with the focus on, you know, citizens looking for a trade, so to speak, and maybe not so much a four-year college, that kind of path.
Yeah.
That they were smart, and this was before I came on board. They had started looking into this surgical technology program, although they kept calling it the surgical technician program, which took me a while to get them to change all that wording.
Uh-huh.
But they, to their credit, they did file the initial paperwork with the KHEP, Request for Accreditation Services. They did all that legwork. Got some clinical sites up and running that we could send our students. And then I came on board. So,
They did some legwork for you.
They did the legwork for me, and that was, and they're still involved. They're still very helpful. So the college decided to run this program. It was a grant-funded program.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so the end result of this accreditation, not to get too far ahead of myself, but it's these people that were given entrance to this grant-funded program are now on the brink of, you know, being hired for well-paying jobs in a great field. So is
the state of Texas, or I'm in Texas. Hello. Let's get this straight.
Yes,
sorry.
You're there.
I'm there. You're awesome. Is New York one of the states that requires certification in order to work as a surgical technologist?
Yes, it is. I believe there are 13 of such states now.
Yes.
So New York is one. Mm-hmm. And so again, big deal. It's a big deal to these people that work so hard. There are 18 graduates that we have that are, you know, like I said before, on the brink or on the cusp of entering this right. field that we both love. So you know, the end result is always worth the hard work, right?
Yeah, that's what definitely. So yeah. Walk me through it. You decided, okay, dig big, deep breath. You know, we're gonna go for it. You're gonna go through KHEP accreditations process. So, you know, the first step is that you have to kind of walk through what what they call the COA, right? Or the Committee on Accreditation specifically for surgical technology at KHEP.
Right. Well,
so talk to me a little bit about what that involves in the very beginning stages, so that if someone is in your position and they're like, okay, we're going for accreditation, I'm going to do it, they get on the website and then they go, I don't think I can do this.
Yes, exactly.
What's the
right.
first step?
I mean, the first step is to get over that you can't do it. That's the very first step. it's kind of like you have to put yourself in a student's frame of mind. You have to become the student at that point.
Right.
Because it is like a graduate degree program that this you're about to enter into. So that's the way I look at it in hindsight. Of course, I didn't know that 2 years ago when I first, like you said, dipped my toe into this water. So
yeah.
The first thing to do is I would say to people, program directors out there, or anybody who may be involved in this process, is to understand that it is KHEP, you're dealing with, and you're also dealing with the Accreditation Review Council, the ARC.
Right.
So it's two separate organizations. So that's the first thing that I think you kind of reconcile in your mind there. So if you're seeking accreditation, the first thing, it sounds funny, but the first thing you have to do is you have to apply.
Right.
So you don't apply to the ARC, you apply to KHEP.
Mm-hmm.
And that does not come from the program director. That information comes from the sponsoring institution and goes directly to KHEP, and that's known as the Request for Accreditation Services, or the RAS form. It's an electronic form. It's fairly straightforward. I think it's $500 to apply. So what you have now, you have the sponsoring institution talking to KHEP. You're not talking to ARC yet. You're not doing anything.
Yeah.
So that's the first step. Then the timeline becomes you sit and wait because there's a lot of waiting, only because there are many, many programs out there that you have to realize.
Right.
These institutions are not just dealing with your college. They're dealing with, you know, hundreds around the country. So what happens next is the ARC now contacts you, the program director, to set up a conference call where you have discussed, set up dates for your initial site visit, make a timeline for your self-study submission. So that conference call comes after you put in the RAS.
So they, so KHEP contacts ARC. ARC then contacts you. And then what does that timeline look like? Is there flexibility in it? Do you say, hey, I know my initial is, you know, 6 months away, but I'm thinking it might take me 9. You know, is there flexibility in the process?
Well, I think there is flexibility, and I think that's just a matter of, normal daily course of business of how flexible it's going to be. If they're super busy or you're super busy, these things could be delayed. However, what you want to remember, my advice would be to remember it's an 8 to 12 month process.
Yeah.
So if something doesn't happen in 2 weeks, it will happen in the third week, and then you're still in that 8 to 12 month window. So, I would suggest to people out there that realize that you're in this for about a year.
Yeah.
Once you make that, and the timeline doesn't start until your self study is the date of your. I'm pretty sure the date of your self study.
Hmm.
So in other words, it's not going to start the day you send the RAS to KHEP. That's
right.
Not the time.
It's your submission date.
Correct.
Yeah. Correct. So I would think that you and I both are trauma scrubs. We like to go in a hurry, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I would imagine the wait is probably very difficult.
Yoga helps.
I think golf helps too, right?
Golf helps, yes.
Maybe
getting
wine.
Outside helps.
Maybe it a glass is. Of wine. Yeah.
It's not so much the wait for me. That's what I found. I found it was the wait for the students. You know, but it's not anything that anybody can do. I mean, I don't even want to go into the details of the timing of our situation because we had a, I'll touch on it briefly, but I don't want to dwell on it because it was just an anomaly because of the pandemic.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah. Our site visit was scheduled for March 26th of 2020.
Right smack in.
Oh,
beginning. Gosh,
yeah. You know,
we didn't know what
was
happening.
The state was shut down on March 24th. So,
oh goodness.
So yeah, I mean, literally, we had the accreditation process. Since we're getting into it now, is that the site visit cannot happen until your students are more than halfway done with their clinicals.
Ah.
So that's the timeline. ARC does not want to come and do a site visit when you're doing your didactic portion.
Right.
If you're doing 6 months and 6 months, I would say. So
that's interesting. I didn't realize that was part of it. But
yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is. It's all timing. So that in our situation, the students were more than halfway through our first cohort now, was more than halfway through their clinical. Some of them were very close to finishing up by March 26th, and we got shut down.
Goodness.
So, yeah, two cohorts were shut down. So, but it really, the bottom line is we got extended about probably 8 months.
Yeah.
But that's, again, nobody's fault. It's just the times we live in. So
it is what it is, as some people
yes,
like
ma'am.
To say.
Yes, ma'am.
So what is, I know there's a template for the self-study, but can you just give me a brief overview of what a self-study encompasses?
I can, absolutely. So the self-study, my advice, it's a very involved document. If I can even call it that, because ours was 525 pages. So,
I'm sorry, what? What'd you
yes,
say?
Ma'am.
500 and what?
25.
Jeez Louise, I thought
yes,
it was
ma'am.
Your accent there for a minute.
No, so. No. No.
Wow.
That is, isn't the way that when I saw that, it's how you eat a horse, right? What do they say in Texas?
Yeah.
How do you eat a horse?
Well, don't start with the rear. Let's just say that. So.
You eat a horse one bite at a time. So that's what came into my mind. Okay, there's this document that we have to, it's not just you two now, you're the program director, you're driving the whole thing, but
sure.
hopefully you have a good support system with you. In my case, I had a very good support system at the college. The accreditation office was excellent in helping. But it's foreign, like you mentioned before, about speaking another language with a college, you know. Now I'm coming back at them with our language.
Yeah.
About cases and scrub, second scrub and first scrub and these kinds of things. So it's you have to be in charge. You have to be the driver of this. Mm-hmm. That would be my advice to people out there, is that do all you can to work with your team, but you're the driver, because ARC looks at you. They look at the dean, and they look at the president of the college, and they look at them as the big three, they call it. So, mm-hmm. Right? You know, yeah. So you're part of the big three now. If you become a program director, that's how you have to get up in the morning and go to work and say, I'm part of the big three. I mean, sometimes you can't bully people, no, but you have to, I think, let the college know that, you know, these are the standards, and you know, help them help you.
Well, and I think taking the time to be as in-depth and as you can in the self-study, and also this is your first chance to really tell them what it is that you need to be successful. So I know there's pressure in that, but at the same time, I would imagine that that's like an incredible opportunity to kind of set the course of a brand new program, which to me seems like a really great challenge.
It was a great challenge, but it also gives you it gets you involved. It's almost like training to become a program director. Mm. And what I mean by that is that I'll be perfectly honest with you. I did not have very good computer skills when I was hired as the program director. You know, I mean, again, coming from the operating room. So if you're out there and you don't have good computer skills, you know, get better at it, but you know, it can be done. If you look at a Word document and you can't transform that into a PDF or vice versa, you'll learn how to do it. Have faith that you will.
Yeah. I remember the first time I was told I needed to submit a seamless PDF with bookmarks. And I was like, what?
That's right. Exactly. Bookmarks and appendices and all kinds of things. But then, you know, that's where you're relying on your administration, your college sponsoring institution. Mm-hmm. So the sponsoring institution is someone who, they're a group of people that need to get involved and help you. Right. So they need to be one phone call away.
So were you teaching at the same time you were also trying to complete this self-study?
I was, yes. I was also, the clinical coordinator. I was teaching cohort number two. Cohort number one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all a blur, but...
I can imagine.
But, you know,
so that's, you know, that's a lot of juggling. How did you manage that?
I tried to be creative. I tried to stick with also, I was creative in the sense that I tried to make it fun for the students with the bodies in the box, and you build bodies and you have some labs, and you know, maybe you put a Foley catheter down in the box and you have a syringe with fake blood attached to it. You tell a student to cut here, and then you squeeze the syringe and the blood goes 3 feet in the air. And, you know, you kind of try to have fun with it. But at the same time, you know that after those students leave at 2:30, you got your other job to do until about 8 or 9 at night. So,
right.
But it's not something that no one else has done before, right? We've all done it. I think that I would say to the people out there also is that if you're going to be serious about getting accredited, you're going to have to look at it as a rigorous examination of your program.
Right. So
as it should be.
I just want to spend maybe two-ish minutes or so, like, on just specifically, do you have tips on completing the self-study for someone who's just starting the process?
I do. And the tips that I have come straight from, believe it or not, the Standards Interpretive Guide.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to bore everybody with reading verbatim from this guide. However, the self-study is really, they want to see if you have the wherewithal as a program to put forth a meaningful experience for your students.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean? That's resources, right? So section 3, standard 3A, as a matter of fact, in section 3 resources of the SIG. Again, I'm not going to bore everybody with these numbers, but I just want to.
I'll definitely link that in our podcast webpage. I'll make sure I link that portion of the SIG to it,
right,
so that people can refer.
It is a big one because it does go through its resources. So they're looking at the type of an amount of resources. Finances, budget, office space, laboratory facilities, instructional reference materials, student and faculty computer resources, clinical affiliation agreements, ancillary student facilities.
Yeah.
All these things are involved. So the way that I tried to do it, and I would advise, not advise, but suggest, is to try to get two things accomplished every day.
Oh, that's a good, break it down, right?
Break it down. You look at this standard interpretive guide. I mean, I'm looking at it today in preparation for this interview, and it's still a little confusing, to be honest with you. So, but if you were not a creature of detail before, you will become a creature of detail because of the self-study. But what it does also, it immerses you, the program director, into your own program.
Right.
And that's what I looked at it as. Related classroom and laboratory equipment. I mean, you think you have what you need or you can make what you need, but you really don't, because there are required items such as OR lights. Exactly right. So you have to look at it from there. They have it in the section 3 and standard 3A resources type and amount.
Yeah.
It's all there for you. And now you need to get your college on board with getting that stuff.
There you go. Well, hey, so we're going to take just a minute break here. And then we're going to delve into kind of what comes after the self-study. All right.
Yes, thanks, Chris. We'll see you in a minute.
Okay, Chris, so we're back. So before we kind of move on from the self-study into kind of the site visit, I just think, gosh, there's so much paperwork. You talked about the 500 plus pages just for your self-study alone. Is there guidance or other paperwork that kind of helps in the entire process that people should be prepared to fill out other than the self-study report?
Yeah, the self-study comes after you've done your request for accreditation services, and that's to KHET from your sponsoring institution. However, once that process plays out, ARC contacts you. We had mentioned that earlier, and you set up a conference call. And during that time, you're also ordering an accreditation packet order form from the ARC. So that's not from KHET, that's from the ARC. It's called the accreditation packet order form. And this form is important for program directors because it kind of gets you down the right path. In other words, if you're standing at, say, Gettysburg, right? Gettysburg had, I think, 6 or 8 different roads that went into it. So you stand in the middle of Gettysburg, you look, which road do I go down? This accreditation packet will point you down the right road to get you started on accreditation. And it includes the documentation needed to develop, prepare, and submit the self-study.
Mm.
right? So that's, you know, you look at this 500-page document and say, I can't do this. Oh, well, look at this. This is an accreditation packet order form that gives me the documentation I need to develop, prepare, and submit that self-study. So that's an important first step for
the program. Is there like a template? You know, if you want me to, I think my anxiety can go through the roof sometimes, I'll be completely honest, especially if I'm not in an adrenaline situation. If I'm in an adrenaline situation, then I'm good. But if someone's not trying to die in front of me, I can kind of get that deer in the headlight look.
Yeah, we all get that, right? Yeah, exactly. So, we're not focused, right?
No, so if they say, like, I need to know about your lab space or your laboratory equipment, you know, at that moment, I'm like, oh my God, do you want me to write you a paper on it? Do you want me to have bullet points? Do I need to have pictures? You want me to put my Instagram photos on there? Like, where is there really specific direction about that kind of stuff? Or do you just kind of wing it?
Well, there is specific directions in the fact that they do, in this packet, you will see that programs should have OR lights, OR table, back tables, ring stands, Mayo stands.
Right.
So that's the guidance that you should have as a beginning initial accreditation eligible program.
Uh-huh.
There's no sense of urgency to that. In other words, I would suggest that if you're doing two things a day, right, and one of them is, let me look at my lab resources, what do I have? Take a long time to look at what you have, and what you can do is you write it out in a long form, what you have. Our lab consists of XYZ, two back tables, four Mayo stands, six kick buckets, one OR table. You write that out in long form. It's not so much a checklist.
Yeah. Is anyone else hearing, and a partridge in a pear
tree? Yeah, well, you'll get that too. There's quite a, like I said, go back to that section three, the resources, type them out. And then, you know, it's, you're talking library resources and, you know, all of those books should be included in your self-study, whatever you have, whatever you can get, a realist textbook, any textbooks that the college has, you can include them in your library.
So do you have to already have all of those things in place? I know, you know, I'm thinking specifically of brand new programs who are seeking accreditation and are starting from scratch. You know, I guess, how much of it needs to already be in play versus this is the actual plan in your self-study? Because I know that the site visit comes at a certain point, but I mean, if you can start, can you use your self-study as a guide to tell the college what it is that you want in order to start the program?
Well, if you're working with your college, like you should be doing closely, they'll know that, hey, you know, the resources they're asking me to show them today that I'm working on is our lab resources. We don't have an OR light, and we don't have a pair of stirrups.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you'll get on the, you know, eBay and start looking for some, or, you know, wherever you go. I mean,
I know a guy who knows a guy.
Yeah, he knows a guy who knows a guy. Chris, where do you get where do you get your caps, your livers from, right? Don't you get something from
right?
The local?
I know. I, you know, there is no sponsor for this podcast program, but we can talk about resources another day, but there are a ton of them because, you know, I might be able to get my packs cheaper from one place to another. I mean, it's just like online shopping.
Yeah, it is.
And I will tell you, I have bought an amputation knife from Amazon before. So, you know, you just, if it can be Instacarted or Amazon purchase, I'm all about it. So, same thing.
There was that kind of process, you know, it's that kind of process where your lab. So the answer to your question about you know, does it guide you towards your self-study? I would suggest that I would talk to ARC about that. In other words, like for instance, we we did not have kick buckets in our lab, yet we still got accredited. But kick buckets are a necessary part of an operating room. So we ad-libbed kick buckets, but we have them now. So, you know, there are things that I would tell a prospective program director, you know, get as much as you can. I guess that would be my my advice.
So I know you said one tip was just kind of take it a bite at a time, do maybe two things a day. Do you want to elaborate on that? Are there other tips maybe that you would give about the self-study?
In this, the self-study, take it page by page. And you know, if you have to stay at work till 9 o'clock at night to get one thing done, that's what you do, because the next day there's a whole nother aspect of the self-study that they want to, you want to make sure, like, I'll give you an example, clinical site scrub slots. That's a big
that's
one.
That's huge. Sure.
Right. So though that's something you can't just pick a page and say, okay, I have 12 students and I have, 14 scrub slots. That sounds great, right? You have enough scrub slots, you're good. But what, you know, you want to make sure that you have those scrub slots. So that day, maybe it may involve calling your clinical partners and making sure, hey, can you still give us 4 scrub slots? And you know, it happened to us. I made that phone call and I was told no, as a matter of fact, because now we're training X amount of new OR nurses because we had some attrition. So that 4 scrub slots that you thought you had 3 months ago is now 1.
Ooh, geez. Yeah.
So those kinds of things, you know, that's the program director. You got to be proactive in that kind of, stuff. Your PAC forms, your PAC minutes, program advisory committees, clinical sufficiency surveys, outcome tracking tools, access to student records. Those kinds of things are, you know, 2 things a day, like I said. It's quite a lot of work.
So in that work, you know, I have reached out several times just as an established program to ARC to ask questions in different moments. And I have found every single person there just an absolute wealth of knowledge. Shout out to specifically Ron, of course, and then Christy Bailey Byers and Crystal Warner. My God, they're never too busy to just pick up the phone. Chris Benarski too. It's a good group, and being a national program, I think to have those people involved and really truly want to help has been phenomenal. But also sometimes, gosh, you just need a peer. Like, you just need somebody who's in your position at another place, or maybe has walked in your shoes, that you can go to and say, you know, help. Who was that for you, Chris?
Well, it was the surgical technology instructor's Facebook page, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic resource. But I want to backtrack a little bit of the ARC and the specific people you mentioned, Ron, and Christy, and Crystal, and all the other, and Chris,
I think everybody named Chris is pretty cool. So
yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny, in the operating room at Stony Brook, there are, I think on the day shift, they were counted 15 Chris's.
No way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was pretty crazy. So, yeah, we like the name, but so the people there, I mean, they pick up the phone, they get right back to you. But on the other hand, I think that you don't want to rely too much on them, because they do have 300 some odd programs out there. So my thought was always to use them as a resource and then get to work, you know, drilling down into whatever I called them for initially. I don't want people out there to think that you can just call them and ask. You can call them certainly and ask them anything you want, but you know, this is kind of a self-driven exercise, this self-study.
I think also sometimes it's about putting your best foot forward and making a great first impression. And like, I don't always want someone to know that underneath the water I'm paddling like a crazy woman. Sometimes I need to come it doesn't help me to come off as a hot mess. So, So I think sometimes you just need, I need those sources, but also I need to know how to intelligently ask for the help that I need.
Yes, I think that's what I was trying to say. And it's I'm glad you put it better than I could. But the people there also have established the Ed Accred I wanted to mention. I think everybody out there should start looking at on the ARC website. There's a link in resources to Ed Accredits, capital E, small d, capital A, Accred. And it is active now for program directors to use as a resource. And what it is accreditation-focused teaching to simplify the process for new program directors or established program directors. And getting, you know, speaking about the people at ARC and the people at Ed Accred, it's about establishing relationships with these people. So they need to know who you are and where you are. That doesn't mean you call them three times a week. That just means you let them know that you're interested and engaged. That's what I would say.
Well, and I can also kind of piggyback on that, because I'm lucky and honored to be on the AST Education and Professional Standards Committee. And so ARC is doing great things with Ed Accred. Pardon my squeaky chair, but also it would be super remiss of me not to mention the amazing work that AST is doing on the education side as well, when it comes to, especially the new changes that are coming with the core curriculum. And so how cool is it that we have our professional organization and our accrediting organization both doing these phenomenally inventive things to really help our program directors and our instructors, you know, create amazing surgical technologists? Because ultimately at the end, the better those two organizations work, the more help we get and the less kind of bureaucracy we have to go through. And then we end up putting out phenomenal people that can care for our patients, which is the ultimate goal, right?
It is. And you know what?
I love both of them. It's a very good point.
It's a top-down approach. In other words, what the Ed Accred people are doing, they are providing education and accreditation services to support educators and enhance the excellence of educational programs. That's their mission statement. So they're working to help us help the students. What they also are doing is they're right now actively building a resource library focused on surgical technology and surgical assisting programs. They're hosting a monthly roundtable conversation next month. Is exciting. I want to be part of it. It's called Better Together, and the topic will focus on, believe it or not, right up my alley, because my students are taking the certification exam. So next month's Ed Accred roundtable is Better Together, and they'll focus on certification examination prep. So, and that's on October 22nd. So shout out.
Is it October 22nd? All right. And we'll put that in our website as well. Yeah. I hear they have a really good podcast, on the Ed Accred too. So that's always a bonus.
Fantastic. So, you know, this, so these resources are out there for program directors. I do want to also say that they run webinars, workshops, and they have digital resources. They are focused on optimizing outcomes for your students. Like you said, Chris, you know, it's all about the student. We always, I think the best of us always remember that that's the person that we're trying to lead into this fantastic field.
One day we're going to be their patients.
Yes, we are. That's correct.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I you know, not to tote the party line here, but I'm so impressed with AST and ARC and all of the resources. So I think everyone should absolutely take a minute. And if you need help, absolutely go on there and take a look. The answer might be there, but also if you can give help, if you can share things that you're doing that you think, hey, someone else might be able to use this in their program. I think we owe it to each other and to our patients all over the nation to share as much as we can. So, you know, listeners, please, you know, share whatever you can do. Cause I guarantee you there are other people sharing as well, you know?
Not without a doubt. I mean, it's, you know, I couldn't have gotten through this without the help of people, you know, sharing things for me. I mean, on that Facebook page and, you know, EdicRed, they have virtual classrooms, publisher resources, podcasts, surgical procedure videos, assessment platforms, self-study development, site visit prep. It's just amazing what they do. Program directors out there that are going through this process should definitely engage with the EdicRed. It can be found on the ARC website under resources. Click on that. I think it's on the right side of the page.
Yeah. So outside of a web page and a Facebook page, is there a person or a college program out there that really you could take this opportunity to have a national platform to say thanks?
Yeah, there is. And it's unbeknownst to them, as a matter of fact, because we did use Colorado Mesa Surgical Technology Programs. We used them as our template for our self-study.
Really?
You can't copy verbatim, and we did not do that, but it was just the way they had gone through their accreditation process, which I believe was fairly recently. I was able to see how they, you know, put their self-study and then use that to help us with our self-study.
Awesome.
Who's
the director there? Do you know?
I think the director has since changed since I was using them in Colorado Mesa, but yeah. I don't have their name.
That's all right. Well, hey, hopefully they're continuing to do great things, and thank you for being a resource for my friend Chris here. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's also a couple other one other program out in Long Island, Western Suffolk BOCES. Janet out there is a fantastic resource. She was, she's never unwilling to give help with anything. And she's only about 20 miles from me. So we're going to rock it out there in Suffolk County and Long Island and produce some first-class surgical tech. She's been doing that already for the last, I think, 16 years. She's got something like 425 graduates. I've worked with many of them, and I know that Janet is a fantastic educator there at Western Suffolk BOCES.
Well, wonderful. Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for taking the, you know, time to recognize them. It's one of my driving forces for doing this podcast is number one, I get to have great conversations to end my day with some really cool people. But also, you know, we surgical technologists are rarely recognized for the good work that we're doing, especially within the operating room, because, you know, our patients are drugged. So the fact that we have a platform that can recognize things, because, gosh, there are some amazing people all over the country that are just so good. You know, I think they deserve the recognition. So.
No, I agree. Cool. I agree. The collaboration, I think that's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
It's so easy. It's just, even you and I mean, I saw you speak in San Antonio about 18 months ago.
I think
it was like 8 o'clock in the morning, and you know, you just rocked it. You just had a way. So I introduced myself to you, and then here we are, having a conversation on this podcast. But since that day I've followed your program, TCCC, what is it?
Tarrant County College. Yep, good old Fort Worth.
So it's been it's been an inspiration to a lot of us to what you're doing there, especially with the podcast too.
Well, thank you, but let's move on for me. Good grief.
Okay. Yeah.
So talk to me then. You get all the self-study, you've put in all of this massive work. Now you're at the right timing with your students to have your initial site visit. Talk to me about what happens in that particular time period.
Okay, so a site visit, you set up, the program director sets up the site visit in that conference call, right? You pick a date, mm-hmm. or and you collaborate with your administration and your sponsoring institution to set aside 2 days at your program. Now, with COVID, you know, things are in flux, right? So, you know, right. they may not be coming to your program for 2 days. In that case, the ARC did a wonderful job and set up virtual site visits, which we happen to be among the first in the country to undergo a virtual site visit because, like I said earlier, our on-site
March.
Visit was, March 26th. So at the time, it wasn't that good.
Way to be the guinea pig there, Chris.
Yeah, kind of we were the first, one of the first. So what I'll do is circle back to not doing a virtual site visit. I'll just kind of, the virtual site visit was something new for everybody. So I think what I'd rather let everybody know is that you are in charge of making the hotel reservations for the site visitors. You, program director, are in charge of the transportation from the airport to your college. The transportation from their hotel to the clinical site. So you have to get all that stuff going on the day before your site visit. Those are details that I wasn't ready for, but we got that done.
Yeah.
And the reservations were made and then it was canceled. So,
So did you go ahead and have a night alone? I would have at that point, I would have been like, and I'm going to take this room.
No,
I'm going to have a breather.
No, I don't think the college would have been too keen on that. So.
I'm just kidding, TCC. I would never do that. Yeah. Oh my gosh. So you are logistically kind of like the travel agent to take care of. Also financially, you're responsible. You as the college entity are responsible for making sure that, you know, all of that is done too. So.
Yeah. Got to be done. It's got to be done in a timely way because, you know, you got to remember, program directors should remember that you're going to bring your site visitors to your clinical sites on day two.
Right.
So you want to schedule that, you know, with military precision. You can't, sure. you know, schedule a 1 o'clock at a clinical site that's 40 miles away when right. you're, you know, at 11 o'clock at the first clinical site. So those kinds of details, you know, people figure out as they go. But
so logistics is really important and just kind of the timing of the day. I would imagine there's kind of a flow, right? You don't want to hurry them, but at the same time, you don't want the site visitors to be in limbo.
Well, there's no limbo because the way that it's done, which I think is the perfect way to do it, the day is broken up into 15 and 20 minute segments. Mm. At 8:45, you're meeting with this person, the program director is meeting with this person, and you're talking about X, Y, and Z. And at 11:30, you're having lunch with cohort one in the break room with the site visitors. It's an informal way to talk to the students. So that's got to be coordinated.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of the site visit, too. The site visitors want to talk to your students without you in the room, or anybody from the faculty for that matter.
Oh, geez. I'm super OCD on occasion. So yeah, it's almost like we are a testing center for the certification exam. So, you know, there's that moment where I have to like stop holding their hand and let go and let them go actually take the exam because I can't be anywhere near them. And so I would imagine it's the same kind of like, be
it
good.
Is. It is.
Be good. Use your manners.
It's funny. There's. I think what you do, and you know, I think you'll agree with me, is what you do is you just let them be themselves. Because mm-hmm. if you try to influence, I feel personally anyway, if you try to influence a student's response to a site visitor,
of course,
I think that will be obvious that you tried to influence. I just didn't worry about that. I said, this program's going to stand on the merits that we've done over the last, you know, 12 months. And if it's good enough, we'll get accredited. If it's not, we won't. So
go back,
that was kind of how I looked at the students with the site visitors. So
I think
ultimately that, I mean, you know, they'll make their own responses.
Man, were graduates available as well? Or did you, I guess, because that was your second cohort?
It was. It was rather, they were both actually active cohorts at the time of our virtual site visit because of the COVID delays. So one cohort number one was finishing their clinicals, and cohort number two was just starting their clinicals. So we didn't have any graduates at the time. Yeah. We do now.
Yes, you do. And they're about to go. They're about to go take that certifying exam.
They're about to go take that test, and I'm going to find out how to jump them on October 22nd.
I promise all of you, all of us are praying along with you. That'll be a big day. So,
Well, thank you.
You've worked hard to get there.
Well, they have. They have worked hard. Everybody's worked hard. The administration, the you know, the adjuncts, the students themselves. But listen, what's the end result of that? The end result is a well-paying job with good benefits and does some good work for the community. You know, that's how I look at it. So,
a couple of minutes also, like what, any tips for how the site visit went, what you may, and was there anything hindsight, gosh, I should have done this or?
Make sure your Wi-Fi is connected, up and running.
That daggum technology again.
That would be tip number one. Yes, especially if you're having a virtual site visit.
Yes,
that's kind of important.
So, I would think so.
Obviously, that was a bit of an issue for me. I had my lab all set up. I was so proud of, you know, I stayed till 8 o'clock the night before setting up the lab, you know, how we do, you know, just so, you know, my Wi-Fi kept kicking out when I was given the virtual tour. So they didn't see, I kind of got one of these, all right, let's just move on.
You're like, no, but this is so good. I work so hard. Yeah.
So that would be tip number one. Tip number two is, I think, you know, it sounds corny, but the proper preparation prevents poor performance. So spend all your time preparing for the site visit, but don't get too crazy. That's where I would put it.
Yeah.
Have confidence that the work you've done is enough.
Yeah.
We all always think we could do more, right? We always think, what did I forget?
Always.
Yeah. But if you stress yourself out too much, you may end up in the ER. So,
let's take just another quick break because I want to hear about what happens next. Because gosh, the big wait, I think, is important. And so, yeah, give me just a minute and then we'll move on.
Yes.
All right, so our grand finale here. I love the kind of the progression of this whole process. I think that it really helps to kind of see that there is an end, you know, and a good ending as well. So
there is, well, that, you know, it's worth the fight.
Yeah. So the site visit, it's 2 days typically. Was that the same? I guess is it still a 2-day kind of event when it was, virtual versus in person? Can you maybe add some more to your thoughts on what that site visit looked like?
Sure. A typical site visit in the, that doesn't occur in a pandemic and is an on-site evaluation of your program is a day and a half to 2 days. You obviously you bank out the whole 2 days, but during that time, you're like I said before, your day is structured just so 45 minutes here, 15 minutes there, 20 minutes here. So before you know it, it's 2:30 and 3 o'clock and the day is over. And then you begin the next day at 7 or 8 o'clock if you're going to your clinical.
Yeah.
But the part of that process begins also, I don't want to overlook this small fact, but it is important, is that the sponsor must provide evidence of their accreditation too, by the way. So you're a program director, you're trying to get a program surgical technology accredited, you want to make sure that your sponsoring institution is as proper up-to-date accreditation too, because
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah, so I mean, legally, I mean, you know, I've heard stories where, oh, our accreditation expired the month before, well, then there's no site visit. So,
Yeah,
so that little detail, and I'm sure that was an oversight of the story that I heard. But so once the site visit's completed, the findings letter, that's the term that you'll become familiar with, the findings letter is sent to the big three, those people that I mentioned earlier.
Yes.
Is sent to the big three in 6 to 8 weeks. So there's a bit of a wait.
Oh, nail biting. Holy gosh.
Yes, ma'am. It's a nail biting time. But like I said before, there's nothing. This process, keep in mind, it's 8 to 12 months, right? The process is that long. So 6 to 8 weeks after these site visitors leave your program is when you hear from the ARC of the site visitors' findings in a findings letter that goes to the big three.
So just to kind of add to that, I can't speak from an initial accreditation standpoint, but I can speak from my viewpoint in our reaccreditation visit that happened at the end of 2019. And I, you know, there's that same pressure to perform, to put your best face forward, to showcase all the great things that you're doing. But, and so there's anxiety, there's apprehension there. But what I was shocked, I think, is that my two site visitors were some of the most incredible people. They immediately put me at ease. They were interested in the things I was showing them. They asked questions. It never once felt combative or an, you know, like an us against them, you know, and flashbacks right now to Jaco visits at the hospital.
Yeah, right.
It just, it was such an a nurturing process and one where I just, it could not have been a better experience for us. Talk to me about the site visitors. I don't think we should probably mention them by name, but like, talk to me about what your feelings are there, because I think that if yours is similar to mine, which I'm pretty sure it is, like that alone, I think can take some of the angst that people who are about to go through this process. You know, that's just one less thing you have to worry about, that they really are there for you versus against you.
No, I agree. They're there for you. And the thing that I learned, I think, was that the ARC, this is what the quote was, and it was from a meeting. I think somebody got up and said, it might have even been at that San Antonio meeting that we both were at, that said, they said, the ARC is not keeping a secret file on your program.
It's not the FBI, right?
So once I heard that, it kind of eased my mind, because you kind of, you know, they're looking at, you know, how does that feel when someone's looking at your program, or you think that they're looking to find something bad? And that's not really what this is all about.
Yeah.
They're looking to maintain the standards of surgical technology education. So that's why they're looking. So you can't, if you're a program director who's prone to be somewhat, I guess I should say, paranoid that, you know, things, why are they looking at me that way? Well, you have to realize that we have, you know, these organizations have to look at us, because we are producing the next generation of surgical tech. So,
yeah.
So if you get past the fact that they're not building a case file on you, they're there to help.
That's a fine way to put it. Yeah.
And like you said, they're just, they're, you know, I don't want to say that I don't, my experience wasn't so much nurturing, because it was more of, it was a virtual site visit, so it was kind of more formal, if that makes sense. There wasn't a lot of, you know, when you're not standing in a room with somebody, you can't really get to know them, is the way I would describe that.
Oh, that's so, a great viewpoint, sure.
Right, so you're just going you know, with this person on the Zoom call and try to relate to them. And you know, but you know, I think if you've reached the level of program director, you have to have some people skills, don't you think?
I hope so.
So you know, you got to use those people skills for your site visit. So, but at the same time, you know, have all your T's crossed and your I's dotted.
Yeah, absolutely. So the timeline from site visit to you get your letter, did you have an idea kind of what to expect from your findings letter before your site visitors left? Or were you kind of in the dark, just, you know, fingers crossed waiting?
No, I kind of knew where the deficiencies were because we did have some citations in our findings letter, which we promptly answered. You as the program, so now you wait 6 to 8 weeks to get your findings letter. Now the program has 6 to 8 weeks to respond to any findings and or concerns by the site visitor. So you have time to gather the troops and formalize a response. And the response is a thoughtful response, and it has to be it has to meet or exceed the standards that are in the SIG. So
I think I want to make sure that we convey to our listeners that that, you know, having some findings isn't the end of the process, that maybe if we see it as an opportunity to refine, then maybe just going at it from that perspective may help to lessen the blow, because I think we're all kind of perfectionist, just due to what we do in the operating room, and that, you know, it needs to be black and white. So
yeah, setup has to be a certain way. Right. Yeah, all that.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, what, talk to me about just, you don't have to get into the specific findings, but, you know, what's your view on that? Like, did you just take a deep breath and dig in and fix it, or?
We looked at it that, you know, we kind of had an idea, or at least I had an idea of where there's a couple of deficiencies. They weren't glaring deficiencies, but they were deficiencies nonetheless that needed to be fixed. And one of them landed right in my lap, and that was the clinical case log tool. I don't mind saying to people out there, as a way of my clinical case log tool that was developed in my program, I thought was spot on. I really did. It included the case, the date, the student's initials. It just wasn't enough. It wasn't up to snuff, and I had to fix that. So we went back to the drawing board and came up with a suitable clinical case log tool that we now use in the program. And I thought that the feedback that I got from the site visitors and in the findings letter was helpful. Because once we produced this new clinical case log tool, I was able to see, you put one next to the other and like, well, that one's way better. So, you know, thanks to ARC, and now we have this solid clinical case log tool, because after all, in this job, that's probably the most important tool that we have to gauge our students' progress.
Yeah, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know. So,
that happened on a daily basis.
Yeah. It still does for me.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. So once you get your findings letter, you have... what did you, I'm sorry, 6 to 8 weeks? Was that right?
Yeah, you have 6 to 8 weeks, and you know, it could take that long. It doesn't have to, but
yeah.
You send that back to them, and it's that same seamless PDF with attachments and things like that. It has to be done exactly right.
Right.
And I want to bring up a small point regarding that. What my take on that was, the ARC is charged with determining if your sponsoring institution and you as program director can administer and even put on a surgical technology program. So I think part of what they're looking for is, do you have the wherewithal as a program to to send these documents in a certain way and to provide the students with this kind of professional environment. So I think there's a reason behind why we are made to submit the documents the way we are. And I think in the long run, it helps.
Yeah. So you didn't just sleep in a Holiday Inn Express. Have you heard that funny commercial?
No. Right? Yes, right. No.
I've got this.
Yeah.
I watched the video. I'm fine. YouTube. Well, yeah.
Yeah. So that's funny. The other thing was the other part that I wanted to bring up for the program directors listening out there is that there's a wait, still another wait to come, and that is after the findings letter is sent back. Now the meetings only occur twice a year in March and September when they discuss accrediting programs or not. Submitting the recommendations, the terminology, I believe.
So that was, when did you submit your findings, like, or your response to the findings? When was that?
That was in December of 2020.
So you just found out, like, last week, wasn't it? Or 2 weeks ago, if I remember.
September 17th, 2021.
A date etched in infamy.
Yes, right? Yes, very good. You took the words right out of my mouth.
Yes.
Besides the fact that my kids being born and my marriage, it was the third happiest day of my life.
Smart answer, Chris. Born. Smart answer.
Yeah. Yes.
So, oh my God, that's an infinitely long time.
It's a wait. It's a wait. Well, their meetings are only through the ARC board meets in March and September, and then KPEP's board meets in, when do they meet? I think they meet in... Do you happen to know, Chris? I forgot all the stuff. Meet in May and November. They meet in May and November, Kayla.
So can we put a shout out to them to try to maybe meet quarterly instead of biannually? Like,
well,
just because it's already hard enough to dye these roots all the damn time. And so I don't need added stress.
It is stressful. Maybe. It's stressful for all of us. But I think what I found was that at this point with the COVID and with the pandemic, and we were stretched out beyond, you know, the normal, I think that it was just, you resign yourself to, okay, we'll find out. But
you're a better man than I am, Chris.
The last days, though, Chris, I knew the meeting was on September 17th.
Yeah.
So some of you out there may go through this. The meeting where they're discussing your program, at KHEP is the final arbiter of your success or not, whether you get accredited or not. And the word is that they let you know immediately, or they put it on the website that you're accredited, I think by midnight of the day of the meeting.
That was not the case. I know firsthand from conversations with you, Mr. Ahern.
Yes, ma'am. That was not the case. However, one of the local programs in Brooklyn, New York, was achieved. Good for them. Happy for them. Their accreditation on the same day that our program was looked at. So their accreditation notification was up on the KHEP website for a full day.
Oh wow!
Before
yours. Oh no!
Goodness. Oh my God! I mean, I was literally looking for a country to move to.
I think you found a state and a golf course to do that.
South Carolina, yes, ma'am. So long story short, I don't want to bore everybody with that, but the wait, like you called it,
it's hard.
It's perfect. It's perfectly descriptive. Is the big wait. It is a big wait for the students, for the administration, and for the program director.
So I hope that you were celebrated. I hope that your students were as excited as you. You know. I hope that there was a massive kind of just weight lifted off of your shoulders and really cheering for all the hard work that the big three did.
Yeah, it is a good feeling. But to me, the kudos goes to the, the students and the administration for even beginning to think about having this program. So, the director directs, right? You direct and you hope that the people around you, perform. And we hope. Exactly. I can in the operating room and in this administrative environment, and I can say that I did my best to direct, and the people around me did their best, and they performed. The students, the administrators that I worked with, the clinical sites, the preceptors, you know, I mean, everybody. And when the news came down the pipe that the program was accredited, there were a lot of, you know, there were a lot of texts and Facebook, you know, notifications. So it was a good feeling.
It's a good day.
Yeah, it's a good day.
So, gosh, you know, that is a big chapter of the life of your program in the books. And a lot of weight, but you know, as we always do in medicine, we move forward. So what's next? You're accredited. What happened? You know, what's your near future looking like?
Well, that's a great question, because this is a time, believe it or not, it's a time of transition. I managed to catch the time of transition for the pandemic and also the transition to now it's mandatory that we're offering an associate's degree for surgical technology.
We're getting there.
Yeah, we are. And it's, you know, exciting things are happening. I mean, the next is, you know, on the state level to make sure everybody's become certified.
Yeah.
I'm attending the New York State Assembly meeting next week, Saturday, as a matter of fact, to try to work towards that.
Aww.
But what's next for our program is the administration at the college is now transitioning and working towards developing an associate's degree in surgical technology. So with that being said, we're in such the beginning stages of that planning that that I've haven't, you know, we don't know yet. There haven't been any meetings yet on the transition. But in my mind, what's next is that we transition and begin offering a 2-year degree in surgical technology sometime in the next 12 to 18 months.
Awesome.
That's what I would say.
Well, and you know, I think that once the paperwork has been done, once the, you know, the certificates have been written and decisions and votes have been made, I think now it's time for us as our instructors and our administration, as, you know, leaders to back up all of the paperwork that we put forward with action. And that means that we utilize all of these incredible things that we have and put out amazing certified surgical technologists that truly have the patient at the heart of everything they do. And so, you know, I have no doubt that you will continue to do that. And of course, you know, the hope is that your administration backs you in every way. And that goes for all of us, right? That we all are.
Are backed up in that
endeavor, if you will. So I think now, like, the real hands-on work starts, right?
To
put this stuff into play.
Well, immediately, you know, it's the certification exam for these 18 graduates. So that's right in front of us now, and we're going to do everything we can. And I'll double back to, you know, the EdAccred meeting on October 22nd. I'm going to learn so much on how to prepare these students. So that's immediately next. And then administration will decide where we go from there. But, you know, I look forward to being able to produce, like you said, people that care about the patient on the table. So patient first, you know, what's our motto, right? Patient, major primo. You know, and I think all of us as educators and even some of you surgical techs out there, you listening, you know who the people in our business that care, and you know that some that are in it just for the patient.
Yeah.
But try to be the person that cares about the patient.
Yeah, you have to put your money where your mouth is, and now it's time to actually, you know, put out the people that you yourself would have operating on you, You know, hopefully our colleges back us in the same way. So, just love that. I'm so happy for you to have gone through this. Thank you. I know this is usually a longer segment or episode than we typically do, but gosh, it's been full of so much useful information that hopefully will help the next person who's in your shoes. And Chris, I couldn't thank you enough for being willing and vulnerable and open to talking to me about how this process went for you. My only hope is that maybe somebody who listens out there can take all of this and use it, and also that it maybe gives them a bit of peace for the process, because it's a daunting process, and one that I hope that now they know that they're definitely not alone in.
Yeah, you're right, Chris, and you know, it's my pleasure to be able to relay my experiences and our team's experiences to the people listening out there. And it's you know, I can't do it because we're not on a video, but there's a thing that says when you're a program director just starting out, you're in this like a ball of fuzzball, right? You're in this fuzzball, but then, yeah, have you seen what I'm talking about? Like you draw with a pen on a piece of paper and it's like a fuzzy line, and then at some point you come out of that cloud and now you say, okay, I've learned so much, but there's still so much to learn. But always keeping in mind that the surgical texts that you put out are what's important. And all of the program directors that are in that crazy cycle, you'll come out of it. You'll come out of it, and you know, you'll have something to hang your hat on that you helped produce the next generation of surgical techs.
Yeah. I think that AST, ARC, our colleagues in the Facebook instructor page, the amazing EdiCred website that is up and running, and all of these different webinars and opportunities that we all have to just connect and ask questions without judgment. I think that I have never been more honored to be a part of a group of people than surgical technology educators, because we take care of each other the way that we take care of our students and the way that we take care of our patients. So I thank you for being open about the help that's out there. Thank you for being vulnerable. So my goal is that we helped somebody tonight, Chris. I really hope
did. I think we did. And, you know, if everybody tunes in all the way to the end, I thank you for staying with us. I think that if people want to reach out, you know, there'll be links, right? I think you're going to put some links.
I'm going to put all of your information on our website.
Good. Fantastic. I'm famous for returning emails within 24 hours. So
oh, you
I
are.
I don't know if that's a good thing.
I'm not.
I shouldn't have just said that. I know I should not have, but
I'm going to test you on that now.
I find it annoying to not have things leaving out there. So if anybody reaches out, I'll be happy to engage in some conversation. I don't have all the answers, but I've been through the process now and come out the other side. So
awesome.
I'm happy to give you a few minutes to talk about it. And thank you for doing this for us, all our surg techs out there.
Oh my gosh, totally, totally my pleasure. I get to hang out with people that I admire, so, and just chit chat. So I don't think that there's a better way to do it. So
sounds good. Love it.
Awesome. Thank you, Chris.
All right, Chris.
And
you're welcome.
I'm grateful.
All right. Always. We'll talk soon, and have a good night.
You too.
Take care. Bye now.
Goodbye.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed hearing from Chris Ahern. If you want to hear more from Chris Ahern and I, guess what? We are speaking at the upcoming EdiCredX conference in San Antonio, Texas, that is happening October 6th through 8th. So if you have a chance, register for that. come hang out with us. I promise you we're a bunch of fun, and you might actually even learn something about surgical technology program management.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Scrub Life podcast. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and share. We can be found on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at the Scrub Life podcast. Show notes for this episode, as well as past episodes, our contact information, and the virtual suggestion box can be found at our webpage, thescrublifepodcast.com. This has been Chris Blevins and Stephanie Austin with the Scrub Life Podcast. Until next time, be safe, support each other, and stay sterile.